I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I sit down with the brothers of Boiled Peanuts fame. They split their time between Charleston and New York. They are the Lee brothers, Matt Lee and Ted Lee. And we're at Empire State South in Atlanta, my restaurant in Midtown. We talk about their new cookbook, Hot Box, Inside Catering, the food world's riskiest business, and how freaking difficult catering is to do well. It's a deep dive into a topic that surrounds us all the time, and we hardly even notice. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it and write a review on your podcast app. That'll help other people find the show. It's nice to show other people. Be a Sherpa. If you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Ruth Reichel is a Plum, which is a great episode, and last week's episode, Deb Perelman is Smitten. Also a great episode. Here's this week's conversation. Matt and Ted Lee explain hot boxes. I'm Hugh Atchison. This is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. We are in Empire State South, and in front of me are two gentlemen who I've known for a very long time, and we've run in the same circles talking about Southern food. And they are very famous for a number of things, but Boiled Peanuts was kind of their first foray into success with boiledpeanuts.com. Was that the actual address?
Yeah.
It is? Yeah. Is it still active? Oh, did you pay GoDaddy on that? GoDaddy always comes.
Sleeping out today.
People always say, how did you get that URL, boiledpeanuts.com? And it's like, if you're foolish enough to start a mail order boiled peanut company in 1994,
you...
1994, literally 25 years.
So that's Matt and Ted Lee, and they just have a new book that we're going to talk a fair bit about, which is called Hot Box, Inside Catering, the Food World's Riskiest Business, and it is published by, who's the imprint?
Henry Holt.
Henry Holt.
Macmillan.
Macmillan, very cool. How are you guys?
Great.
Doing great.
You're splitting time. You've split up.
Yeah, we split up.
Yeah.
But Ted's in New York, I'm in Charleston.
Yeah, Matt's in Charleston.
He's the smart
full one. Full-time with a suburban household, a wife, and three boys. All boys, right?
Yes.
All boys.
The Lee brothers.
And
take two.
Ted's still in Brooklyn.
I'm in Brooklyn with my wife. She's a contemporary artist. We live and work in the same amazing loft. I was able to build out a kitchen. She has her studio. And we love it there.
That's awesome.
But I get down to Charleston like 1 week every month or so. So it works out great.
And this book is it's a bit of a deviation from the normal cookbooks of sorts. I mean, last cookbook that came out was really a Charleston Receipts type of cookbook about the cooking of Charleston.
Yeah, it was a deep dive on a place. You know, we had done the broad Southern cookbook, the simple, fresh Southern, like the way we actually cook on weeknights kind of cookbook. And then we wanted to go like super deep on the stories, the characters, and the ingredients. But this is a career pivot. We didn't want to slice the Southern food pie thinner and do the Lee Brothers bacon book or the Lee Brothers vegetarian love or any of that.
Natalie Dupree's made a career out of that. There's always a Southern cookbook
James
in there
Phyllis,
somewhere.
Yeah, but anyhow. Our
but no,
creative,
I love Natalie.
Those are beautiful careers, but like, you know, for us, we wanted, we needed something else.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we had a door open for us, and we stepped through it.
And you stepped into the world of catering, which is such a strange world. Well, let's first of all explain to the world out there, because I know what it is. Mm-hmm. What's a hot box?
A hot box is a dumb, boring aluminum cabinet on casters, tall, mostly empty. It has rails to receive sheet pans. How many do you know by heart? Like it's 46 or something.
It's 32.
I think it's like 28, 32, 42.
But anyhow, in most places it's used just to move food from one side of the kitchen to the other. In New York City, around about the early 1970s, this one guy hacked it to create a jury-rigged oven, basically.
The Crestcore.
They don't even really endorse its use, but widely now, for decades in New York City, caterers have used it to move the food to the site, on the box truck, to the museum, or out into the open field, and then once there, emptied, turned into an oven with sternos. Like you'll put two or three sheet pans just crowded with sternos. You light them all, in one swoop.
And it's such a decidedly, it's a very distinct smell of burning sterno. Well, it's supposed to be no fragrance in it, but I can always tell you when it's burning. It's like burning dry.
It's jellied alcohol. It's a really weird substance.
Oh, it's like napalm.
Yeah.
It's like simple man's napalm.
Yeah. I once spilled some on me and...
While it was aflame?
No.
Okay, that's good.
And everyone was like, ah! And it's kind of cold and horrific, but the thing is just a chill, and it just... It evaporates like alcohol pretty quickly.
I wonder if it'll evaporate into your pores and make you drunk or kill you.
It might.
But you're still
didn't
here.
Kill us. Yeah, we just didn't do enough time in catering.
It's kind of the secret to doing catered food at a large scale in New York City, because there's no other system that is approved by the fire marshal to do.
So you wouldn't really be able to have open flames. So you couldn't just hook up a big grill or something like that.
No propane.
So these are just sort of ambient heat sources. So they'll pack one of these hot boxes on the lowest level. They'll pack it with like 20 sternos, and that'll create an ambient temperature of sort of 225, like a really low roasting oven. But it's hotter. Like most food goes out, you know, a steak's at 125 Fahrenheit, and that's the center of the steak. So you need the exterior to be kind of 150. So that 200 level is kind of the ideal. That's where like plates are going to get heated.
Right.
The vegetables kind of finish roasting, and it can hold that.
I mean, even you'll put your bread baskets wrapped in plastic on the top of it because it'll still have that
plates. You might have a pasta course in there wrapped in plastic.
Oh, that's going to be good.
I've seen a hot pasta loaded with everything.
Why do people cater with pasta? Salad maybe, but pasta. Yeah, like, it's never good.
Ravioli.
Never a good idea.
Ravioli and gravy holds pretty well, especially when it's in the gravy already.
We kind of got ahead of ourselves. I mean, we didn't even learn what a hot box was until after... We had this experience at the James Beard House in New York City, which for your listeners who may not be aware of it, there probably aren't many, but it's a 75-seat venue. They host guests mostly, you know, guest chefs, restaurant chefs from out of town. You've probably cooked there.
I've cooked there many, many times. Right. And I still have a scar on my head by hitting my head on...
It's a very small residential kitchen.
Beard lived in this house, and it was his sort of weird. There's not the word to describe it. It's a really weirdly designed house. Like the third floor and the bathrooms and stuff like that are really flamboyant and odd for the 70s and mirrored.
Yeah.
And then the actual kitchen is huge for a home kitchen, but really
converted the base.
Not well designed for serving a 7-8 course meal for 75.
So, you know, we were observing another restaurant chef from Atlanta who was doing an event there, and he'd brought in three guys from a catering company, sort of as backup, you know, to execute, because you know what you're doing if you're coming in from out of town is doing an off-premise event, and as you know, they're not easy to do, especially at five courses. And so we watched these guys who are caterers walk in that venue at 5 p.m., never having cooked there, never having cooked with you know the chef. Steven Satterfield, and you know, they kind of crushed it, and they just moved in a way that was different from either home cooks or restaurant chefs we've witnessed, you know, and they just had a resourcefulness that was incredible.
But that's because these people, that's what they do. They're kind of the specialists. Now, catering kitchens, like large-scale catering and even small caterings, I mean, it's kind of like MacGyvering everything together. Just transport on the way there is a nightmare. It's all coolers. Everything needs to be hyper-organized. But catering is this weird function of, it's kind of like doing TV. There's a lot of hurry up, and then there's a lot of wait. Yeah. And there's a lot of downtime of kind of waiting for things to happen as the food slowly degrades.
Right.
Well, you know, you make all this planning. It's all about the planning and the preparation. And then you get on site and the run of show doesn't go as planned.
Right.
You know, those toasts go on too long. And there you are, yes, in suspension, just like holding food in the way that's, you know, least degrading and yet, you know, still quite warm.
So did you ever have, I mean, pulling off great food under those conditions is really difficult. Was some of this food exceptionally good?
Most of it was. I mean, that's a real surprise to us, having embedded there for 4 years, is that these chefs who are strictly catering chefs are swinging for the bleachers. I mean, they cannot. Part of that is New York. Like, it's the highest of expectations. The average diner at a gala or some wedding or anything in New York City is going to be someone who has dined at fancy restaurants around the world. They've tasted amazing food. They paid $2,000 a plate for this gala, and like, rubber chicken is not going to cut it.
Right.
And so you have to bring, you know, full top restaurant level intelligence to your menu design and to the flourishes. And, you know, Danny Meyer got into the business, not entirely successfully at the beginning, but like, you know, smart money has gone this direction because there's a ton of money to be made in catering. People need this right. as a service, but it presents these incredible logistical hurdles that no restaurant chef can really even fathom unless they've done it before.
I mean, it really is triaging mistake after mistake as they come, as the event unfolds.
And the contingencies, you know, the contingencies of schedule, you know, the toast, the drunk father of the bride, toast runs long. There are those things, but there's also, like, you know, you have
weather.
You have this, you know, you have a lawn in East Hampton and it's like soaked with rain from the day before, or it's about to.
What was the term in the book for somebody forgetting something back at the catering facility?
A rerun. Yeah.
Yeah. The rerun. Getting back in the truck that in New York you've just taken 20 minutes to park and have to go back because somebody forgot the one tray of sweet potato chips that they desperately need.
Yeah. It pretty much happens on every gig. I did this one at the Frick Museum where it was the trustees board meeting, just like 12 billionaires, me, Juan Soto, and Patrick Phelan, three of us, and Cesar, the driver, and he had to go back for white cranberry juice because the Frick outlaws any red wine or any red cranberry juice. That's just their rules. Like, you can't harm the carpets there.
How many white cranberry juices did they sell that night?
I mean, they weren't selling any. Probably no one called for it, but it was just like a requirement. One of these crazy things. And so he had to like slog across crosstown traffic.
Yeah, you need it there because you're trying to satisfy, you know, the event planner of the museum, and she's the one who pays the bills and brings you back in 3 months when there's another board meeting. And so it's this just like
almost 85% of catering is repeat business. And so there's this escalating, like, bar raising thing where if it's an annual event.
Yeah, it was great last year, but this year I really want to up the ante. Yeah, we've got some other guests coming.
Right.
It's like, oh, what do you want? You know,
the
it's
board like, members, they get bored. Like, people want novelty, and it can't be the same year after year. It has to get better.
Right.
We want a Chiappino, you know, table side. It's that's not, okay.
Yeah.
And then they have to figure it out, which is never easy. But that's the thing, is like, everything is about figuring things out in the world of catering. But it's also about a lot of mild disasters. I remember catering a very large wedding in Macon with my crew probably about a dozen years ago. And it was a beautiful wedding. But we got there, we were setting up shop. I've got a crew of about 10 people. We're setting up huge grills with propane. And they've already got a massive tent with some heaters. Those heaters that blow like big flame type of things.
Yeah.
And it's right next to where I'm hooking this stuff up. So it's open flame. It's full throttle. It's on. It's heating this tent. And what I'm hooking up this grill, and one of the propane tanks, the threading goes wrong. And it's lodged in, but the safety valves, it done it, and it won't work. So it's chugging out propane in my hands. It's funny, my staff ran over and they were like, do you want me to help? I was like, at this point in time, I thought I was going to die. So I was like, no, but you should get out of here. And I sort of like lay on top of the propane tank, and I finally got it closed and looked at my hands, and my hands were completely bubbled. Propane's really, really cold chemical.
Yeah.
And it doesn't burn in traditional way, but it burns like a chemical burn.
Right.
So my hands expanded by about three times. They were just like bubbles.
God.
I remember driving back to Athens from Macon, like, with my, like, I don't know, the ends of my arms, not using my hands because it hurt so bad.
My God.
Propane is no joke.
But these type of things in catering scenarios happen all the time. They're the most important thing at a big catering like that is somebody bring the first aid kit.
Yeah.
Because inevitably.
Bring the first aid kit. There's always like a waiter fainting and taking down a jack stand of 120 desserts that you've just plated up. I mean, it's always some disaster.
And then, you know, modern cookery is half based on the Benrinner plastic green mandolin, which is the most devastating tool in a kitchen if you don't use it properly. I make all of my people put on two plastic gloves on one hand, on their cutting hand, before they do it. Because if it cuts you, then at least you got two layers of fake skin on top of you.
At least we can like put a finger cut on top of it and put you back to work.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing that about catering that's so different from restaurant and really just makes it so terrible, which is that there's this expectation that everyone's going to be served more or less simultaneously. Like in a restaurant, it's spread out over different tables and different parts of the menu in a given night. Imagine if that was your frame of reference, having this, you know, this drop where it's 1,000 plates, all the same thing. You know, how does that stress out your kitchen?
But that's the thing is like, okay, so on setting up a catering, usually you go in these, you know, the 6 foot table is built into a 24 by 6 table. And then you run a sort of assembly line. You're sliding a plate down and you're building your plate left to right. And you've got the 6 elements that are on the plate. You got people doing identical things, mirroring each other on both sides of the table. That get expedited at the end. Even with that system, it takes 20 minutes to plate up 150 plates. Yeah, so were you guys working in scenarios where you had like multiple 10 of
kitchens.
Those?
Totally. Yeah. So for 4,400 people at the Javits, you have 4 kitchens, each serving out 1,100 people.
You're talking about the Robin Hood Gala.
Yeah,
and
the Robin Hood
it's coming
Gala.
Up in May. And,
yeah, it's coming up.
You know, the talent is usually.
Yeah. What is the Robin Hood?
It's like Robin Hood. It's like these like Robin guilty Hood hedge fund guys who are like.
Do you get to rob from them? They're just benevolently giving it away?
Hedge fund guys who like. Want to raise money to assuage their guilt. And so they literally raise like $60 million in one night. So each ticket's like $5,000. It's 4,400 people.
Huh.
And they auction off stuff and it's Sting and Bruno Mars. And, you know, it's a big deal, but it's, you know, it's also sort of under the radar because it is this like extravagant over the top thing. But yeah, it's, so each kitchen is serving 1,100 people. So there's basically like, you know, 6 serving lines.
Hold on, we've got some food coming to the table.
Wow,
it's
amazing.
Okay. So right here we're going to have the lamb pâté. This is a beef braisolo. This is going to be goat sausage. And we also have cotechino and then beef bologna,
mustards, blood sausage, pickles. Beer mustard, grain mustard.
Oh, beer mustard.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to be snacking a little bit as we go, but you guys help yourselves.
Yeah. Thank you.
So you kind of laid out the world of catering in the prep cooks and then the actual people on site doing plate up. And there seemed to be a decided advantage to working prep, except when it came to money.
Yeah.
That the people who go to the events and cook at the events were almost paid double what the prep cooks were paid.
Right.
We were paid $10 an hour in the prep kitchen.
No, you're worth it.
And then...
Thanks.
And the fiesta, you know, it's prep or fiesta, and it's character defining.
Prep or fiesta.
Most people don't cross over. We did both prep $10 an hour, fiesta $25 an hour.
Wow, more than double.
Yeah, but prep is spread over the week, you know, during the day.
And you can pick up your kids after school.
Exactly.
And...
So it's usually people who want a more regular schedule, whereas if you're working fiesta, you might not be guaranteed, you might be guaranteed maybe 3 nights a week, but you might... You know,
and
so usually people
in December you're guaranteed 8 that you can't do, but then in you know February there's 1.
Yeah, it's like dead. So,
yeah,
you know you have to be nimble, and everyone's a mercenary. Everyone's on like five bookers, you know, call sheet. So you have to work for multiple firms if you're working fiesta. You know, you can pretty much if you do the daytime prep gig, you can pretty much rely on. you know.
Oh my God, boiled peanuts.
Boiled peanuts and jars.
Oh
wow.
My gosh, imagine. What are these? What are these?
What are these?
Yum.
We've got more food coming. What do we have?
Oh my God.
Pizza with a bacon marmalade. This is going to be pork rillette with pepper jelly, smoked fish mousse with pickled mustard seeds, and a whipped ricotta with olive oil and herb.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, the book, it's really interesting, but it really is a departure from cookbooks.
Yeah.
So writing this type of book, I know how to kind of write cookbooks at this point. I hope so. I've written like four of them. I think I'm still learning. But was this completely different?
This took so long, 6 years. It took 2 extra years. We blew through the deadline because it was hard to figure out how to write long stuff and to just digest all the material we had acquired, whether it was our experiences or the interviews we did. So after we embedded, we
did you just use the term embedded?
Yes.
Okay. Are you allowed to use that when it's not war?
I don't know. This is
you have my blessing.
Kitchen nightmares.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You're not the first person to blanch at the use of that word.
Embedded. Yeah. Yeah.
We went undercover.
Okay.
We worked.
Nice.
But then we just interviewed, and we interviewed Danny Meyer, and we interviewed Liz Newmark, and we interviewed, the party rentals guy who'd been doing that for 30 years.
The elephant?
The big pink hippo.
Big pink hippo.
Party rental. Yeah, party rental.
You
limited.
See that company everywhere now.
Everywhere, man.
They killed that category. They just gobbled everything up and built the biggest mountain of stuff so that most event planners are going to call them because they have it all.
The thing is, where do they keep it all? I mean, just the amount. That's the other thing I don't think people understand is, like, if you're catering for 100 people and it's a 7-course wine paired dinner, do you realize how many stems of glassware is? That's like 4 van loads of just glassware. And that's for like 100 people. Yeah, if it's for, 3,000.
So the Robin Hood benefit with 4,400 people, there's 3 tractor trailers filled with nothing but chairs.
Wow. That's just, it's just a crazy part of the industry. There's so many parts of the world of hospitality and food service that I think we see, it's kind of like farming. We have a beautiful bucolic idea of it, but we never see the actual machinations behind it. They've been hidden from us on purpose.
Right.
And, like, nobody really wants to see a catering kitchen.
No one does, not even the caterers.
But, if you go into the firm, someone was recently asking us, like, so what would you suggest if someone's, like, going to hire a caterer? Like, how do you know that they're good or whatever? And it's like, well, just go to the tasting and ask to see the kitchen, because I do think, like, at a decent firm that's doing great work, if you step in that kitchen, it'll be chilled out.
There'll be a semblance of order. But there are other ones I've walked into who are executing our dinners, and there's like somebody just stabbed somebody, and it's like, oh my, this is not good.
But and to go back to it took a really long time for us to do this book. It was totally different from doing a cookbook, and the way you spend your time, like doing interviews, doing the experiential part of being at the parties and then just processing it and being like, oh my gosh, like,
where's the story here?
Where do I go from here? How do I make the linkages? How do I take a reader who's not familiar with this material through this in a way that makes sense? And so we sort of came to that kind of, it took us a while to find out to get in our groove and to realize that we were going to need to do a chapter on allergies and on food design and
weddings.
Sort of pull back from that, like, you're in the scene and I'm stressing the canapé. Like, you'd need to, like, for the next chapter, you need to take a breath and sort of, like, see the big picture, So there's sort of a balance that you're playing with.
How do you guys write as a team?
It's sort of like your writer-editor relationship. We have fairly similar sense of tastes and writing styles. But we're different people, and so we can see the same paragraph in, a new light, fresh light. It's kind of fun because
that actually just probably makes
doodling, and then you just send it to him for his appraisal, and he might edit, he might add to it, he might subtract. But at least you have fresh eyes on it, and you can kind of move it forward.
But I like that idea. Faster. It's almost like you're continually editing each other in a smart way, and your kinship, it's kind of like you two are brothers. So it makes it easy.
You know, I do think there is this way in which it always moves the ball forward. Like, I don't think, like, I never get an edit or a piece of material back from Matt where I think, like, oh my gosh, like, I'm going to have to redo, you know, like, this was the wrong direction. Like, it just, it always sort
I've
of
sometimes
builds.
Had that feeling, but
when I do it, yeah. Well, I
you don't
I tend
say
to,
it out loud.
I tend to go,
it's very rare, but one time I just had to overrule. I am the older brother.
Which, what piece was it?
Recently.
I'm curious. It was recently? On
it was
what?
Recently. I just had a better start. I can't remember what it was. It probably wasn't even anything important.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was a surprise. And I was like, no, you totally, that's totally wrong. But, you know, at the end of the day,
the stakes were low on whatever that
was. It's like, we're not oncologists. It's just, you know.
Nobody's going to die.
Nobody.
Well, in the catering kitchen, maybe.
We'll still, you know.
I want that goat sausage, whatever which one that was. I think it's that. Yeah. Thank you.
You're going in. I'm going to stick my thumb in the middle.
Kind of like a pizza.
Do it. Thank you. So let's, you guys have for years done a writer's sort of retreat, how to write your cookbook type of seminar. How did that start?
It was fairly organic. I mean, we would just be at food festivals and, you know, young chefs, food writers who would say, hey, man, can I buy you a bourbon and pick your brain about how this whole publishing thing goes on? And you'd sort of be like, you really need to, like, it's really a longer conversation.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of decisions that need to be made. And we need to sort of unload some reality on you, too, because, like, from the outside, I think people look, we've, you know,
cha-ching!
Published. Yeah, like, they're thinking,
ain't like that.
We've published 3 books we're proud of. They've won awards. But it's not exactly a business. You know, it's not exactly, I mean, it's not like a money, it's not an engine for
part
money.
Of the portfolio.
So it's part of a portfolio of hustles that we do,
including boiled peanuts,
cobble together an existence. But it's, so we developed a series of seminars that happen
it's
over
just
2 days.
A 2-day intensive like workshop environment called Cookbook Boot Camp. There's
right.
The militaristic thing again, but
and you're embedding people in the world of
they
cookbooks.
Embed in our world for 2 days. We do a little bit of remedial college up front and really talk about like how to best express yourself, what you do, because fresh, seasonal, local is not enough as a chef. You know, you have to go deeper and you have to be, you know. We make them cry. Like,
but I mean,
like,
when I did my first cookbook, I had no idea even how to submit a proposal. And
some people think that you write the book first and then sell it. You know, and so it's like there's good news and bad news.
Yes,
the bad news is they're jaded New York editors and they're gonna look down their nose at your proposal. But the good news is you only have to spend 2 weekends and get 35 pages together, maybe 10 recipes, and you're off and running.
But the wonderful my photographer in the first 2 books was Rynn Allen.
Y'all
know
her. She's amazing.
Rynn is amazing, Athens-based artist and photographer. But she and I, both of us knew little about submitting a proposal. So we made the craziest proposal ever to send to people.
Hold on. So you're actually a case study in Cookbook Boot Camp, and it's what not to do. And we hand around your original proposal. We have a copy. I don't know how we got it. And we hand it around the room, and everyone passes around and is like, oh, Hugh, he's such a visionary. This is so cool. This is like a zine. It's like
this.
An art project. And we're like, this is how, you know, a publisher is going to say, not for me. You know, it was like too expressive of your idea. We're like,
well,
you know, Helvetica 12 and like no pictures, just like let them see something in it.
You know, I still stand by that proposal. It was this very big success story, and the book went to an auction on the first one because of that. And it was because it was the thing that people couldn't, they couldn't ignore on their desk, which was good. Now, it's not something that could be repeated. Many times.
Right. No, it was kind of the brilliant idea, and you did it so, you and Rynn did it so beautifully. It looks so good. And then we show them the actual book and show how it evolved, how the project evolved from the proposal to the finished product.
It's also, I mean, you know, when you were selling that proposal, you were Hugh Atchison, so you could do that
Oh, they didn't know me from Adam.
You were already on television.
Come on, no, it was pre-TV.
Really? Yeah. Really?
I don't know.
But I do feel like you were secure enough in who you were, and you and Rin did have this vision for the book that was very specific, and you probably didn't want to work with anyone who didn't want to see that vision.
Right.
Whereas, you know, our advice to, you know, a younger chef sort of coming up, you know, may have been on, may have gotten some attention is like, you know, if you don't have a specific sense of what you want it to be, you should make sure it's like 12-point Helvetica, yep, because they want to imagine what it could.
You guys really submit with Helvetica? Because I have to turn my books into Times New Roman.
No, we do. Oh, it might be. We do Courier, 12-point Courier.
12-point Courier. Whoa, you guys are crazy.
Super old generic.
Super old school.
We actually do stencil.
You may have PTSD from the being embedded for so long with yes, catering trucks, but yeah.
Embedded in high school in 1987.
Yeah, yeah.
But so we love that. Excuse me.
It's fun to teach, you know, after the kind of hermetic, like, freelance writing thing, to come out and just, like, say, this is how it's done. Our parents are academics. Our little sister's an academic, and we probably should have been.
There's a lot of similarity. My dad's an academic, and my oldest sister's an academic, so, yeah. That's the family I was raised in. It's funny that I never would think, like, when I was growing up, that some of my proudest times are, like, writer's workshops and things like that, but I love geeking out on that stuff. I went to a writer's retreat with Janice Ray at her little house out in the middle of nowhere, middle Georgia.
Uh-huh. How cool.
And she wrote Crackle Childhood and Seed Underground, a bunch of other books. And it was just a revelatory day of sort of rehashing how you write and how you get things out on paper.
Well,
words are fun.
That's, you know, day one of the program is sort of like you make those decisions. It's the most personal day where you're telling your story, and there's writing exercises. And it is this thing where most of the chefs coming to boot camp, like, they literally haven't had, you know, an hour to themselves to, like, think about where they've been and where they've come. They're just, like, thinking about them. And the great stuff happens in that day. And, like, people cry and people laugh. And it's, like, this, like, awesome, you know, intense thing. And we have six chefs per session. And it becomes this kind of group, you know, therapy, but also, you know, decisions get made. Like, are you going to write the book? Or are you going to hire someone else to write the book?
Is the book about you and your cooking, or is it more a restaurant book?
Yeah. And the money always in reading contracts, it's like you get $100,000 advance and 15 of it goes to a literary agent, and then you're going to spend 20 to 30 on photography, which also comes out of your budget. I mean, they charge back now on making the index and things that. Right. So, you know, it's not as lucrative as the time you're going to put into it. If you really want to whittle it down, it'll be well below minimum wage if you document all the hours that you put into a book.
I remember saying to a younger chef who was sort of surprised, like, "Oh wow, it's like this isn't like an engine of cash." And it's like, no, what you need to be working on is your next liquor license. Like, if you or if you don't own it, getting a piece of that.
Let's talk about Southern food overall. What's the current state of Southern food? Don't just Charlestonize it. Your scene's good.
I mean,
your scene's strong,
let's set
man.
The stage here. You know, Hominy Grill announced they're closing.
I know.
Crook's Corner has been taken over. Yeah. So the classics, you know, the strong, you know, reliables are reinventing themselves in some fashion. But it's, I think, never been a more exciting time to be engaged or love Southern food, whether it's restaurant or home cooking.
I mean, it's interesting also that, you know, we're sitting down here and you, like us, don't have a Southern grandmother.
No.
So,
which is, like you guys did this catering book, that is really insightful, embed into the world of catering. I find that I have an interesting vantage point, as you guys do, into Southern culture because I'm actually not from here.
Right.
And I talk about this in I think my first book, but I often talk about it in public, but, you know, nobody if you have a Southern grandmother, her popcorn or her deep fried okra is always going to be the best. Nobody's right. ever going to be able to compare, right. but that's not objective. So it's always interesting.
Yeah. Mm. But we, you know, we're just super excited about, you know, the voices that, you know, I mean, think about the books that have come from Atlanta in the last year, like Coconut and Collard Greens, Von mm-hmm. Diaz's book,
yep.
you know, a Puerto Rican woman grew up in Atlanta, and that perspective is amazing. It's, you know, it's a fabulous book. Turnip Greens and Tortillas, mm-hmm. you know, Eddie Hernandez's book. Todd Richards' yeah. book, just got nominated for IACP Award.
Yep.
You know, this is exciting. You know, this is like new voices coming to the table, and we feel really positive.
Oh, and then people like Michael Twitty, who wrote Cooking Gene. Yeah. He did.
Yes, he came to boot camp.
So there's just so many good thinkers about what it means, what Southern food actually means, right. because it's been so distorted. Even in the last 20 years, it's had so much of a prism of new definition that's important.
Yeah. yeah. And I just think, you know, people are telling the stories that we sort of told ourselves that we're retelling other people's ways of telling the story, and now they're being told deeper. You know, I think the original, the sort of, people are going back to the original sources and being like, wait, now, this was the handed down, like, fable about how this dish came about, but let's go and really
examine
more sources. You know, we have more materials, earlier, more archives.
Like, called deep dive. Yeah. Deep dive, I mean, well, and that's the modern sense of getting to the bottom of something.
Scientific or academic rigor being brought to bear on food history in a way that, you know, is considered a backwater of, it wasn't really history. I mean, I think there are actually...
Are you saying Paula Deen's been lying to me?
Professors of food history at some of the nation's colleges now.
Yeah.
Not the case.
So Paula Deen's not lying
to me. I think she's teaching at Harvard, yeah.
Oh, she is. Good. She's embedded at Harvard. So what's next with you guys? What are you working on now?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we still feel like there are so many questions we raise in Hotbox that we haven't sort of answered in our own minds. So this going on tour with the book is so fun because we get to interact with caterers across the country who are sort of, you know, we were a little concerned we were shining a light on their business in this way, but finding like they're super grateful because it does bring up things about
gives credence to how hard they work and the shit they have to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, and why was it so hidden for all those years? Why was this book not already written? We searched high and low to find something.
Because a lot of caterers
like
have shone a light on their operation and the roaches run out. But right. yeah.
No, they can't. It's a self-fulfilling thing. Like, they are excellent food producers because if the roaches did crawl out, they would be dead. Their business would be dead.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really sink or swim in catering. Yeah. And we wrote it for people who know nothing about this world, of course, kind of. The main reader was a guest. We wanted it to resonate and be true to the caterer's experience. But what we're discovering now that it's out is that every other person has some relationship to catering. Either they did it in the past, they're doing it now, or a relative did it, or, you know.
It's the Kitchen Confidential of the catering world.
Oh, yeah. Catering Confidential was like the working title.
Was it?
Yeah. The shorthand.
The shorthand for it. If we had to explain it to someone in two words.
I always do point out that, you know, it's more like Heat, I think. Do you remember Bill Buford's
book? Yeah. Heat?
Because he sort of dropped into Babbo Kitchen and then worked there and then
pulled out.
And, you know, the Kitchen Confidential, you know, Anthony Bourdain lived that life and wrote that book. So it's a way more personal and, you know,
deeply.
Yeah, and this is more investigative in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so it's sort of a more sociological, you know, it's not like, I mean, yes, we were transformed by our experience, but we didn't live it. We had the privilege of dropping into that world.
Did Kitchen Confidential have like lists of crazy statistics and stuff?
We've got
like Harper's Index kind of statistics in the party rentals chapter or the weddings chapter and stuff
You know, and just the weird thing
geeky
about like
stuff that we couldn't resist.
Wedding trends, like there's this one firm in New York that in 2016 sold 600 and something portions of burrata, and in 2017 sold 25,000.
Yeah, that's so like that's that trend, shows like that, you the food yeah, trend the, impact.
That impact is just like when it's at scale, it just
kale went from 25,000 cases to one.
Right.
The like flash, the backlash against kale.
The kale backlash.
My favorite detail and statistic is that the standard, like how many ounces is it? 12.5 ounce stemmed all-purpose wine glass.
Yeah,
costs
here it is, right here.
The party rental company. Yep. What is it?
Cost of party, so most commonly rented item in the Party Rental Limited product catalog is a 10.5-ounce all-purpose stemmed glass. Cost of Party Rental Limited of that glass, 50 cents. Price to rent, 83 cents.
Highway robbery, right?
It's so, more than the cost of it.
Yeah.
The
it's,
cost of goods sold is
a pretty good deal. But then read down further. How many do they have in inventory? 100,000.
They've got 100,000 of them. Well, yeah, that's not that much. That's only $50,000 because they're
renting them over, but how many do they lose in a year?
Quantity of the glassware that they have, it's equivalent to their running inventory.
So they lose their entire inventory every year to breakage.
But that's great.
Yeah. So basically the cost of renting it is the cost of them keeping it from breaking.
So why wouldn't you? They just the guy schlepping around
that,
probably
the tray that
them.
Holds those glasses and that they ship to the site in costs like $75. It's actually ridiculously expensive. And they're always losing those. But then also just the cost of washing. Like the party rentals business is really a washing business.
So did you go in there?
Yes.
Was that amazing?
Oh, it was like Alice in Wonderland. Dude, it was so insane.
Yeah, I haven't gotten that far. I got it halfway through, but I need to get into that.
Food 52's excerpting that chapter.
It's one of five.
Daily Beast excerpted that chapter.
So you can read it online for free.
At thedailybeast.com.
At thedailybeast.com.
Food 52 is doing the allergies chapter.
And it's an 800,000 square foot warehouse, and it's one of about five along the eastern seaboard. And it's the biggest one. And it's just insane because it's at the same as it's a storage operation, it's also a washing operation because everything gets sent out.
But it's probably the
filthy.
Easiest. Well, but the rental contract usually stipulates that you have to at least get them debris free. You have to clear the dishes.
Party rental
in New York. The reality is no.
They have nothing.
Like there's a lamb chop so stuck to the bottom of it.
Everyone's scribbling in Sharpie on the tablecloths and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like half the tablecloth.
Drawing the entree and where the like spetzel goes and stuff like that. I mean, everyone abuses the party rental stuff for sure.
And so that's why they charge 83 cents a glass versus on a 50 cent cost mark.
It's so funny. No, he said like that was one of the first quotes. The shit that comes back in, you know, because it's like literally caked on food.
Dried.
You know? It's like they just like take the hotel pan with like half the macaroni and cheese left and just throw it back into the thing, you know.
It's crazy. Crazy
so
wild.
It's such a crazy
so
world.
How big is the book tour?
It's like 12 or 14 cities. That
pretty big.
Publishers sponsoring. Yeah, it's like
it's
old
publishers
school.
Paying?
Yeah, for
nice. Aspiring writers
we went to the
get
West
that
Coast.
In your contract.
Yeah. Yeah. We went to the West Coast.
Whoa.
Seattle, San Francisco, LA.
Not really. We were on a panel with Ruth Reichel.
And, I love Ruth Reichel. She's a special person to me.
She kissed us on the lips.
She kissed you on the lips? Yeah. I'm so jealous. You know, I'm going to write a haiku about that and tweet it later.
Please do.
No, she's amazing.
We had a great panel out there.
My last book tour was so weird. I got a free Airstream, and we motored around the country.
Oh my God, just to make your life easy.
Yeah, no, it was fun, though.
Did you love it?
Yeah, it was the slow cooker book. So the only downside is I'd wake up in the morning after camping out with like four slow cookers cooking all night long and smell like a pork butt, which is not great. Three dudes and four pork butts.
Airstream. That's funny.
It was a strange trip, awesome. But it was a lot of fun.
We like book tour. I mean, it's if you truly throw yourself into it like you did and make it like a performance art piece or campaign, and try to, you know, do three events a day and just knock down, drag out, wear yourself out, meet all your great chef friends. It can be fun.
Yeah.
It's
and effective.
And it can be really effective. The one book tour thing I always want to do is just do farmers markets because there's just an amazing amount of people and they're all interested in food and they're there for the right reasons. They usually have cash in their pocket or you can swipe a card or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, the old idea of, you know, selling cookbooks by going to a restaurant and doing dinners where each customer gets a book, it's just like there's so much work that goes into that on book tour
to make that
happen.
Oh, yep. Yeah. And even with our cookbooks, we're usually one of the events we're doing during the, whatever day it is a cooking class or a demo. And so then you have to bring that level of like,
yeah,
you have to bring a whisk.
Prep for
even
that.
Even if you're not doing, even if you sent them the demo agenda in advance, you still have to like check it off, you know, checklist.
You and figure out how you're going to cook it. Yeah. I've been watching, I've got a bee in my bonnet because I now want to do a Netflix show or something like that on the, reboot of Galloping Gourmet. Did you guys ever watch that show?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Graham Kerr.
We republished that book with
that's Rizzoli right, with imprint. Rizzoli.
Yeah, so yeah.
You guys can get the Graham Kerr Galloping Gourmet cookbook by Rizzoli or Rizzoli.
Yeah.
Rizzoli, yeah.
That's awesome. That's because of you guys. That's hilarious.
He's a friend. Like I've got.
So he used to shoot
all
that.
His voicemails on here saved because he's so hilarious. Because
his voice is, yeah, he's so funny. Great. But he used to tape those in Ottawa, where I'm from.
Yeah.
That's right. Which is so weird. And he stopped the year I was born. So there's like this simpatico.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I'm now, I'm trying to get a production company interested in doing that.
That'd be great. We'd be happy to connect you with him.
I would love to. He's like 85 now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's still galloping.
He lives independently and he drives a Nissan Versa and pumps his own gas. Oh, actually, I talked to him recently. He switched to an electric vehicle.
Okay. Cool. No more Nissan Versa.
That was his excuse for not attending our book event last week.
But he was
out of range.
He was. You know, he was super ahead of his time, you know, a cooking entertainer.
Oh, he was so entertaining, bumbling. But he also used to make crazy amount of mistakes on air, but they were more funny to him than the entire audience. He thought it was hilarious when he'd do it.
Masterful comedian entertainer.
Like just really fast. And everything. Yeah, his cadence is just like, he's just really quick on his feet and just funny.
He's still out there.
Yeah. Well, Matt, Ted, thanks for coming.
Hugh, thanks.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be on.
They're noshing. And we're going
to
leave.
Thanks to Empire State South for this spread of.
It's a spread of goodness.
Stir the pot, baby.
Stir it away. Go ahead and buy Matt and Ted's book. It's called Hot Box Inside Catering, the food world's riskiest business. Thanks a lot. Eat well. Be swell. This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location at Empire State South in Midtown Atlanta. Scott Porch produces the show and Mackenzie Mazzell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, rate, review, and come back Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. It's been another weird week. Let's get through this. Thanks for listening. Eat well, be swell.